Okay, I see we have a lot of visitors here with us tonight, and with the holidays, that's not a big surprise. We've got a lot of people traveling, and we are glad you guys could be with us. You're joining us in the middle of a survey. We're going through the Bible narrative, and we have recently completed discussing the United Kingdom. We finished talking about the life of Solomon, and now we're just going through the wisdom literature, and we're doing a crash course through Ecclesiastes. We had one lesson on it that we began the class with last time, and then we will conclude tonight with Ecclesiastes part 2. And the main theme of Ecclesiastes that we discussed last time is, I think probably the best way to say it is what Solomon said, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, what is the context of that statement? What is the limitation on that we discussed last time? This life under the sun, right? So it's limited. That comes from a perspective of life without God. If that's the viewpoint that we bring to this life, then at the end of the day, that's what we're going to find. All is vanity. Now, the main point is if we're not already well acquainted with that point, to come to grips with it. And then once we realize that, Solomon's point is to teach us how to find enjoyment, fulfillment in this life with the foundation of what? What's the main thing that he's trying to persuade us of? And the conclusion that he comes up with more than once, not just at the end of the book, but to fear God. And we come up with that four different times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a reoccurring theme. So with the foundation of fearing God, with that in place, then we have the perspective to enjoy the proper things in life with certain limitations, understanding that they're only supposed to provide some amount of fleeting pleasure. They're not supposed to be an eternal, lasting pleasure. So even then, with the right perspective, we have to put these pleasures in perspective. Okay, we are on page 35, which is in lesson 21. We're finishing up lesson 21. And Ecclesiastes is broken up into four discourses. And at the end of each discourse, he comes to this very similar related conclusion. And we're in discourse number 2. And we left with question number 6. So before we get to that, what other lessons have impressed you as we've come to this point in Ecclesiastes so far? What else jumps out as something that you think has been meaningful to you?
God's will for us to labor. Do the best we can do from there. But always, God's given us that. He wants us to do that.
Right. So he is giving us this task. And we talked about this last time. This is how we ended the class. It's kind of a dilemma or a conundrum of sorts. God has put a hunger or a desire, this thirst within us, but yet then he's put us in a situation where it's impossible to fulfill that hunger, that thirst, or that desire. And this was the question we left with last time. God's not a capricious God. He's not a cruel God. So why did he do that? Let's back up the question first. What's the hunger or the thirst that he's instilled within us? What is it that we seek, that all men seek? Purpose, fulfillment. Let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 3. This is one of the key passages, I think. It's a pivotal passage in the book. In verse 9, we just talked about the different times that God has arranged. There's different times for different things in life, and this is something we need to be aware of. And the wise will recognize those different times. But he asked the question in verse 9. Ecclesiastes 3:9. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He, that's God, has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So this eternity, this is a hole, if you will, some need or some desire that reaches out for eternity, for something beyond this life, something that's lasting, some purpose that goes beyond just what we see here. However, it can't be fulfilled in this life. It can't be fulfilled with the things that we see around us. And go back to chapter 2 that we looked at earlier. Whether you fill your life with all the different pleasures and buildings and projects and friends and possessions and whatever, there's just no possible way to fulfill that hunger or that need or that desire. So now this question, why has God done that? Why has he done that to us? You guys are just too talkative for me tonight.
so you can discover.
You think about if we could actually find some kind of purpose that was, if the illusion was made real, that there was something there we felt like, oh, if I do this, then I'll find purpose. And what if we were able to go through our whole life and never realize that it was empty? What would we all do? We would all just fritter our lives away on meaningless things. But God, by putting up this hymn, this boundary around us and this wall that we all run into, He's forcing us to say, okay, there is nothing in this life. There is nothing within this boundary. And that forces us to look somewhere else. That this life under the sun is ultimately meaningless. Therefore, we have to look beyond the sun, to God, to a Creator, to find some final meaning, some final purpose. Let's keep reading in chapter 3. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. So again, going back to our foundation, this is what God has given to us, is some enjoyment that we can find in this life. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been. And God requires an account of what is past. So again, we have the reaffirmation that God is in control. God has arranged these things that we looked at earlier in the first part of the chapter. There's a design, there's a purpose, and the purpose is to drive men to fear God so that we would learn to fear Him. And so He's deliberately forcing us to realize the emptiness of this world so that we will look somewhere else, look to Him to find ultimate fulfillment. All right. We're not going to have time to look at all these passages in detail, so we're going to fly through the rest of it pretty quickly. At this point in verse 16, he says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work." So what he begins at this point in the book is he's kind of laid down one of his main themes or his main premises, and he's stated this, that God's in control and that we have to learn to look toward Him and to find our answer. And so we have to learn to fear and to trust Him. So at this point, he begins to deal with reactions or problems based off that conclusion. In other words, people, and you hear this from lots of different people, well, if God is really in control of this world, how can He let the righteous people suffer? How can He let this happen? How can He let this kind of king or this kind of ruler be in power? How can God allow this and this and that and whatnot? And Solomon does, he goes through and begins to tackle some of these common inequalities that we all see, and he begins to deal with them. And he deals with them, I think, in three different ways. First of all, on a lot of these, he says, you don't have enough data. You don't have all the facts. You're missing some facts. And so he helps us to fill in some of the facts. Things are maybe not as they appear. The second thing that he does is sometimes our observations are correct, that we have realized something that's a true problem, a real problem. And what he does is he gives us advice and guidance how to avoid this evil thing within this world, and how to avoid it, and how to, or at least minimize it. And then some things that we observe, Solomon recognizes and says, God's going to have to take care of that. And that's a good example of what we looked at just here, where he says, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. Sometimes things seem backwards. The wicked people prosper and the righteous people suffer. That doesn't seem quite right. And the only way that can be reconciled is if you look at verse 17. There is a time and a place coming beyond this sun that God is going to judge all men. And the righteous, they may suffer now, but in eternity that will be made right. The wicked, they may prosper now, but in eternity that will be made right. So these are the three different ways that he deals with these problems. And starting, as we noted here in verse 16, chapter 3, he begins to go through several different of these. In verses 18 through 22, he deals with the problem of the fact that all men are going to die, that it's just like animals that we approach death, and from the appearance of life under the sun, you can't see the difference. And again, he brings up the point that God does this, that He tests man to help us see our condition and where we are going. And again, this is to generate trust and to generate fear and respect for God. in verse chapter 4, beginning there, he says, "Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun." So again, he begins to make some more observations about different forms of oppression and work and things that we think, well, these may not quite be right. This is some difficulty or some evil in this world. And again, when he uses the word evil or vanity, a lot of times he's not talking about morality as far as righteousness and wickedness, but something that just doesn't seem good or doesn't seem consistent. It's not something that's pleasant, something we would expect or something that we would want. So he touches on working and some of the difficulties that people run into there. Some people work for no purpose. Some people work alone. And so again, he advises us on the importance or the value of having friendship, of having companions. This is one of the ways to help mitigate some of the evil and the frustration in this life. And then we get to chapter 5, and we have it seems like kind of an unusual section as he's going through this. He says, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore let your words be few." So then he continues to tell us to be careful as we approach God. And he says in verse 7, "For in the multitude of dreams and in many words there is also vanity, but fear God." So we have one of our questions on this. Given the context, why is it important to guard your mouth before God? This seems an important, valuable, almost obvious lesson. So why does he bring it up at this point in the context? We were going through different inequalities that we see in life, and we're looking at these in response to the fact that God is in control. So why now the encouragement or the advice to be careful how you speak to God and don't speak too quickly? How does that fit in? Marcia?
We can look at it and say all the inequalities, and then we can use our mouth in God and one to be rash with your mouth, all these, and think of it, and got wise and foolish, and you may find it.
So, think back to Psalm 73 that we looked at before last time. Remember how he talked about, it was very similar problem, very similar thoughts, that how here was wickedness, it was prospering, it was being prolonged, here was a righteous person, they were suffering, their life was coming to an end early. How do you reconcile those things? Remember the psalmist in that case was struggling with this, and he said that he made the point that if he had opened his mouth and if he had proclaimed this, he would have been untrue or unfaithful to his generation. In other words, if he had voiced his doubt prematurely, then he would have said something that he would have later regretted. And it's, yes, Job could be definitely an example of that. But if you look at the psalmist in 73, what happens after that? Before he gives in to that, before he echoes his doubts and voices that for everybody, he waits, and what happens? Remember, he goes to the temple to worship, and there he remembers the end of the wicked and what's going to happen. And so he thinks about the latter end, and then he is able to reconcile all those things. So in a very much a similar way, our reaction could be the same. As we're looking at these different inequalities, these injustices, we could say, well, that's not right. What is God doing? And if we're not careful, we could start saying something that we would later regret through rashness or through just through our forgetting of who we are, where we are. We are human, we are man, and God is on heaven. God is in heaven sitting on His throne. And He has power and He has knowledge and wisdom that we just cannot even imagine. So we have to be careful. We are so limited, and we have to remember that. So I think that's fitting advice as we go through these different problems to remember who we are and be careful that we don't accuse God or say something too rashly that we might regret, or that we might invoke Him in some way. I think that's also hinted as well, that we might seek His help and promise something that we could know that we couldn't possibly begin to keep track of. So be very careful on both sides of that fence. All right. So as we go through chapter 5, I think what he does is in verses 8 through 20, that again, he's pointing out the fact, go back to our three different ways of answering these inequalities. Maybe we don't have all the information. Maybe things are not quite as they appear to be. And so as he talks about the wealth and the honor and the gain that different people have, he reminds us that wealth is fleeting. It's here today and it's gone tomorrow. So we may see somebody and say, well, they have all these things. That's not fair. Well, they may have it today, but what about tomorrow? It may not be there tomorrow. And then also looking at verse 12, for the wealthy, there's this fear, this paranoia. What happens if they're going to lose this? What have I got to do? They're always strategizing, make sure they're increasing and they're adding to this. And so there's no peace. They can't even sleep comfortably because they're always worrying about their wealth. And so they may look like they have things better, but that's not necessarily the case. So he's reminding us that, and he's, as he does so many times, he's admonishing us to look down the road and to use foresight and to use wisdom and plan for that. And you look at verse 15, to remember that just as we came into this world naked from our mother's womb, in the same way we're going to return naked as well, back to the dust, unable to carry anything out with our hands. All right, so then we have our conclusion here at the end of this the second discourse. Here's what I've seen is good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. So we have our conclusion kind of restated. Food, drink, our work, enjoy those things. This is the gift from God. Assuming that we are pleasing to God, this is something that he's arranged for us to have enjoyment and to find pleasure in. But how has he expounded upon that conclusion? How has he added to it? What other piece of advice or wisdom is extra now? And that's part of the key of enjoying it, right? Is realizing that it's not what we depend on. What we depend on is God, and enjoy it just for today, because tomorrow it may be gone. So it's not, we're not trying to build our life on those things, and we're not trying to make that an enduring pleasure. And as long as we have that limited view, then we can enjoy what we have today. I think one of the things that he adds to this is, before we talked about just very simple pleasures, but in here, in this last case, he's talking about somebody who's wealthy, who has an abundance. And instead of, there's kind of extreme ways of dealing with this. Some people may feel very guilty because of their abundance or because of their wealth. They may not be able to enjoy it. And he's telling them that they should be able to, again, with the proper setting, the proper context, that we should be able to enjoy the things that God has given to us, even the wealthy, because this is something that God has given to him. All right, any other thoughts before we go into the third discourse in lesson 22? All right, so as we go into chapter 6, he again continues to deal with some of these, you know, different injustices and different inequalities that we may run into. And we have throughout chapter 6, and you see it also through chapter 7, there is a lesson of contentment. To make sure that the things that God has given us, to be content with that. Not to be seeking to try to continue to increase in abundance and wealth, but learn to be thankful for what we have and to enjoy what we have, not depend upon it, and not make that the essence of our life, but to be content. And so, as Paul said in Philippians 4:11, in whatever state we are, to be content. Now he asks this question in verse 11 and 12. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in all his life, all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? So he poses this question, and again, it's similar to what we've already been discussing. How do we know what is good in this life? How do we know what avenue to take? How are we going to invest our life in a way that's going to bring forth good? And how are we going to know that? Because you won't know until you get to the end, and then it's too late. And how do you know even at that point that this truly is the best thing that's going to happen for you? You need somebody with a higher perspective, a broader perspective, that can stand from eternity and say, this is what's good for man. And so, beginning in chapter 7, he's encouraging us He mentions several different proverbs. I'll read a few of them. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. And let's skip to verse 8. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. So as you look at these verses, and I'm assuming that you've already looked at this ahead of time, in Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 10, what do all these proverbs have in common here? What common point do they have? This is question number 2. What do you think? So there's a contrast there between wisdom and foolishness. So there's this value between and sorrow and what that brings to us and what that forces us to do versus happiness. What else? So all the things that we're discussing, how do they appear in the near term? Immediately, how would they appear to us? If somebody said, hey, there's this party going on at this place, or there's a funeral going on at this place, what would you rather do? Well, you would rather go to the party, right? And would you rather be with people who are laughing, or would you rather be with people who are crying? Obviously, you're going to want to be with the people who are laughing. That's the thing that's immediately enjoyable to us. It's immediately satisfying. That's what makes the most sense when we look at the short term and the near term. In all these things, he's telling us, look past the short term. Look past the near term. The wise person, it seems like they just waste their time away. But they're not. They're investing in the future. They're using foresight and they're looking down the road and they're planning for something. They're planning for an event, whether it's life's end and life beyond this life or whatever in the ultimate sense. In all these things, he's admonishing us to look past the what seems to be the most valuable in the near term, to look to the long term. So he's admonishing us to take this this far-sighted perspective. And we have this advice in 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. So if I had to pick a word to explain wisdom, one of the words I would pick would be farsight or foresight. It's this desire, this interest, and this commitment to look down the road and to understand how things work so that we can make a decision today that will make our life better in the future. And that requires foresight. And that requires a lot of planning and a lot of thinking. And to me, that's the epitome of what wisdom is. And this is what he's admonishing us to do. And that's part of how we resolve these inequalities and these injustices. These things exist because we take a short-term view. Once we take a long-term view, then most of the inequalities and most of the injustices just fade away as this world is burned up. Okay, so now we get chapter 7 to me is a pivotal chapter, and there's several good verses in here, and I actually had one request to look at one of the verses, so I'll make sure that we look at this. So let's read verses 13 and 14 and then get to our question 3. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. So what is the purpose of the inequalities that we observe? And then secondly, how should we react? Right. That's right. So we've discussed that so far, and he takes that conclusion. I think he extends it. He builds a little bit further in these verses. It's to let us know that there is no fulfillment here and to get us to look beyond that. But there's something I think even more personal that he brings up in these two verses. You don't know what's going to happen to you. You, personally. Look at verse 14. He's talked about the adversity and the prosperity. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. This is a theme that we're going to see again in chapter 9. When we look at life, we can't tell if God's favoring us or if he's disfavoring us. Why? Why is that? Again, because we see people that are clearly righteous but yet they're suffering. And there's people that are clearly wicked and they're prospering. So when we look at what's happening around us, we can't tell if God is actually in favor of us, if He appreciates what we're doing, if we're going the right way, or if we're going the wrong way. We can't use the events that are around us. So again, there's this uncertainty to our final end is built into this life. There's no way to tell what's going to happen to us based on the things that are happening to us. There's no relation, no connection between them. So that's one of the important lessons. Any thoughts before we leave that?
Thing we need to keep in mind that is that God is in control, regardless of whether we're happy or sad or whatever. And our trust in Him, I don't know what's going to happen.
That's right. That's right. So these things are to build up trust and to build up faith.
Paul said that the Lord is fine. The chapter was telling them that it makes up what four or five things.
That's right. That's right. Very good point. So then how should we react? I think you've already answered this between you and Buford. When we're in these situations, it should give us pause to consider. It should give us opportunity to look to God, and it should deepen our strength, or make us stronger by deepening our trust and our faith in God. So that's what we should do in adversity. How about prosperity? Be joyful. Be thankful for what's been given to you. Again, it should bring us closer to God and appreciate what we have, what He's given to us, and appreciate His mercy and His compassion toward us. That's right. That's right. Very good point. So, these kinds of thoughts would not allow us to become arrogant. This would promote humility. Very good point. A couple other verses I thought of. In Romans 8, I don't think I have it on this one, where we're told that God subjected the creation to vanity in hope. There was a reason why He did this. He had some purpose. He had some hope to bring something about. And we're told in Acts 17, in Paul's sermon there on Mars Hill, we're told that God appointed the boundaries and the times for man so that man might seek after Him and might grope after Him and find Him, even though He's not very far from us. So we see in the New Testament, as well as what's being alluded to here in the Old Testament, that these boundaries, these difficulties, these inequalities, they're meant to drive us toward God. And God did it not because He's cruel or capricious, but because He hopes we will learn the lesson, that we will wake up and that we will take advantage of this time and learn to draw closer to Him and trust and in fear. Right. Right.
As well as giving us all these things, He's also put up
there. So there's lots of different things that God has provided as goads that kind of drive us in the direction that He wants us to go. And again, that goes back to one of our other points. That's part of the reason we're accountable when we don't follow those goads, is because He hasn't left us on our own without direction or without influence. He has these things here that should bring us to Him. Okay, so there's an interesting passage in verse 15. I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There's a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. And then he has this advice: do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? So I know I didn't ask this as one of the questions, but what do you think that means? Is he saying, well, you can do a little bit of wickedness, just make sure you don't go overboard, and it's good to be good, but let's not be goody-goody either and go to that extreme? Is that what he's saying? Is he telling us to, you know, be moderate?
In your own eyes. In your own eyes, Tennessee, you would be, if you were satisfied a criteria that you have established for yourself, that would be the idea of being overly righteous, that is, in our own eyes. You're not saying it's overly righteous, really.
Right.
He's just saying that we're going overboard on our own account and for ourselves.
Right.
And for our own fulfillment.
Right, right. Remember who we're serving. We're serving a perfect, a holy God. Until we reach perfection and that level of holiness, we cannot have gone too far. And looking at the other extreme thing about some of the Psalms, where the psalmist there says, I hate every false way, I hate wickedness. God admonishes an extreme view of right and wrong. We are to be right as much as possible, and we are to avoid wrong as much as possible, and we are to loathe that. So clearly he's not doing that. Putting it back in its context, what is the main point we've been looking at so far? Take the long view. Don't look at the short term. Sometimes appearances are deceiving. What we first think or we first judge may not be right. And this gets back to what Brother Lambert said. Not to be righteous in our own eyes. I think we have that same admonition in Proverbs 3:7 about not being wise in our own eyes. So we can think through many different ways, whether, and Bob mentions this in Colossians 2:18-23, whether we make extra rules up and we say, oh, well, I've done this and look how much better I am than you because I do all these extra things that you don't do. Whether it's that way or it's through some martyr complex, oh, look how I've suffered, I must be better than everybody else. However we trick ourselves into thinking that we're better than other people, it's a very destructive and a very dangerous thing because it's setting us up for a fall. We, in our own eyes, we are overly righteous, more righteous than we really are. Same thing about wicked. People can say, you know, God doesn't love me. He does. After all the things I've done, I'm just too wicked. I'm too bad. I've done too much. Or there's no recovery. There's no hope for me. Think about Judas, what he must have been thinking after he realized what he had done. There was no hope in his mind. There was no faith. So he went and he ended his life. These are two extreme views of ourself that we are to avoid. And we're to take, again, the long view and to look at our life the way God sees us. And I think the next few verses fit into this, this admonition for wisdom we see in verse 19 and then in verse 20. Again, this protection against thinking too highly of ourselves. For there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. And also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also, your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. So there's this remembrance. You're not as good as you think you are. Be careful you're not fooling yourself. And so all these things this is advice that he's given to us to be careful of appearances, to take the long view. So he says, and here was the passage that was requested to explain. In verses 23-29, he says, all this I have proved by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? So the advice that he's given to us, he's proven, he's demonstrated, he's verified this using his observations, his experience, his wisdom, and he said, this is good. I need to be wise, just like he's been admonishing us to be. And he's saying, I will be wise. I'm going to figure out all these things. And then what happened to him? How far did he get? The more he learned, the more he realized that he didn't know. He just touched the hem of the garment. And the wisdom that he was really seeking, the answers to everything, was just so far from him. He couldn't even begin to approach it. And remember who's talking to us. This is Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. So he says, I applied my heart to know, in verse 25, to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things. So he's looking for the underlying, the whys and the hows. And an example of this is to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. Go back to Proverbs and think about that simple man that he saw from his vantage point on top of his house. The simple man walking through the street. He does some foolish things, makes some foolish choices. He finds himself in a very foolhardily, he finds himself in a very tempting and destructive environment, and then wickedly he sins. And that just leads to more and more wickedness. So you see this progression from just simple naivety to foolishness and to destruction and to wickedness. And so I think he's trying to understand the whys and the hows. How do people go? Why do people sin the way they do? You know, the questions aren't really supplied here. He's trying to answer all the questions related to these kinds of things. And this is just one example. Why is God saving people the way he is? How does he choose one over the other? Why does one person do this versus another? All these things he's trying to find out. How are people influenced this way? And one of the things he finds in verse 26 is, he says, and I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets. whose hands are fetters. He who escapes, he who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. So he's trying to understand this progression, this change, and what is one of the things that he's found? Well, think back. This is Solomon. Who was he married to? He had 1,000 pagan wives. And clearly these people are going to be, and remember what happened to him? They drew him into their pagan idolatry. And he's recalling this, how really his descent and his destruction. And so this is something that he's personally found, and apparently it's still an influence and a distress for him, because he says, "I find it," not something that he's necessarily found. So verse 27, adding one thing to another, trying to add these things together and find up the reason, but he still hasn't found it. Trying to understand why men are the way they are, why God has done what he does. He has found, he says, one man, this would be like one upright, one worthy man among 1,000, but among the same 1,000, he's not even found a woman of these. And I think this is not a stereotypical statement toward women in general. If you go to Scripture, you don't find that backed up anywhere. In fact, there's lots of things to say that women stand on an equal footing spiritually with men. So I think, again, this goes back to his personal experience, what he has found. Remember who he surrounded himself with. And his point is to get to verse 29. "Truly this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." And the women in his life were an example of this, about how people begin life upright, good, innocent, but yet they begin to seek out ways to scheme, to do things that they know are wrong, and to pull other people into it. And this was something that he experienced and that he lived in his life, and that is typical of all people, that we all begin life as good and upright, but yet we seek out many different schemes. All right, very quickly, we have some more wisdom that's provided, more inequalities that he deals with. And again, in chapter 10, we deal with the value of wisdom, and we have a demonstration and a defense of, again, taking this long view. And we get to chapter 11, which I think is a very pivotal chapter in this. As you get to this, it's very easy to take a cynical view of life, saying, what's the point? What's the use? This is not going to work out. And the point of chapter 11 is optimism. It's saying there's a point. We got two bells. There's a point in our life, and we don't know what's going to work out better or best. And so to invest our life equally, try to invest all these different things, and we don't know, to try and take an optimistic view in life. Verses 9, 10, and then verse 1 of chapter 12, the three R's: rejoice, remove, and remember. The admonishment to the youth and to all of us to be thankful, enjoy the good things that God has given us, and to put away sorrow from our heart, not to dwell unduly on these evil things. But the only way to do this is to make sure that we fear God and that we've built our life on Him, and to put away sin and evil from our life. And he says we need to do this because, again, taking this long view, where are we all headed? And this is, he very poetically paints this picture of these closing days where everything is winding down, everything is breaking down, and we're getting to this point where life, there's no pleasure, there's no enjoyment anymore. And so, again, very stark awakening to realize where we're going, that we're going back to God. In verse 6, remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity is a vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. So again, tying the two bookends, tying it all together. What is life without God? If we just focus on this life under the sun, it's vanity of vanities. But skipping to the conclusion here in verse 13 and 14, if we fear God and keep His commandments, this is man's all. This is what completes man. This is where he finds his ultimate enjoyment and pleasure. And if we do that, then we will find the meaning in life. And we are to do this by balancing and remembering that God is going to bring every secret work, everything that we do, into judgment. All right. Thank you for your comments and your attention as we flew through Ecclesiastes.